Raise your hand if you're a tomato promoter, poultry wizard, mayor, doctor, brigadier general, university chancellor, assistant president of the LDS church, mason, and proponent of spiritual wifery. Anyone? Anyone have all of those talents? Oh, wait, I see a hand in the back. What's your name, young man? John C. Bennett? Oh, well, welcome to the podcast, little guy. Hi, this is Lindsay Hanson Park.
And this is Brian Buchanan.
Bringing you the story of Mormonism from the shadow of the everlasting hills, straight out of Zion. This isn't your grandpa's Mormon history.
Well, I have sinned so gravely, Brother Brigham, Brother Young. I have sinned so gravely, Brother Young.
This is the tale of Mormon saints and sinners from our roots until present day. Saddle up.
Gird your loins, lock your hearts, and pay your tithing, because we're bringing you the story of Mormonism in all its paradisiacal glory.
It's the Sunstone History Podcast.
Well, I've sinned so gravely, Brother Brigham, Brother Young. I've sinned so gravely, Brother Young. That only you can save me, Brother Brigham, Brother Young. But only you can save me, Brother Young.
On November 28, 1839, Joseph Smith and his buddy Elias Higbee galloped into the nation's capital, Washington, D.C., after traveling hard on a month-long journey from Nauvoo. Where was Amtrak when you needed it? What would follow the next 3 months was an attempt by Smith and his friends to get the President of the United States to stand behind the Mormons and sanction their cause. We already talked about this at the beginning of the season, but I want you to think about how unusual it is to imagine this scenario in a modern-day setting. You can't have somebody like Jim Harmston or, God forbid, Warren Jeffs, men who felt like their religious movements were being threatened by outsiders, just roll up to the White House and ask to speak to the President. Actually, I think Jim Harmston rolling up to the White House and talking with Trump, the COVID-positive Donald J. Trump, can you imagine these guys just rolling up to the White House and asking to speak to the President? That's exactly what happened with Joseph Smith and his buddies. Higbee and Smith met with President Martin Van Buren on November 29th, 1839, and then again in February of the next year.
Why were they there? Well, our favorite topic, religious persecution, of course. They wanted redress for the suffering that the Mormons had experienced in Missouri, and it was pretty bad. A lot of bad stuff happened. Smith was so confident in his cause and apparently in America's government that he felt completely comfortable seeking the help of the President of the United States of America. So during their February meeting, Van Buren made an apocryphal declaration. It is said that Van Buren told the Mormons three times in the mirror, "Gentlemen, your cause is just, but I can do nothing for you. If I take up for you, I shall lose the vote of Missouri." So what's the difference between a blessing and a curse? What about a prophecy? Because Joseph Smith did one of those things as he left D.C. in a tiff. On my way home, Joseph Smith would write, "I did not fail to proclaim the iniquity and insolence of Martin Van Buren toward myself and an injured people, and may he never be elected again to any office of trust or power." Whether curse or prophetic vision, Van Buren would lose to William Henry Harrison, the Whig candidate in the election of 1840, if only it would have helped those pesky Mormons.
Oh no, that wasn't even the bad thing that happened to him. Later, when Wilford Woodruff goes to do all the temple work for the presidents, he doesn't do Martin Van Buren because he sucks.
Really? I don't think I knew that.
Sorry, Martin.
Also, if you're keeping track of the prophecy revelations come true board, I believe we're at number 3 so far.
Civil War is definitely just the top of that board. So yeah, all this power and excitement expected to come out of Washington, D.C. ended up with a big... After this, Smith's confidence in the protection of the federal government began deteriorating, just as fast as many of his friendships in Nauvoo. Smith would try to get more involved politically, and when he got tired of the system, decided to just create his own. Just 2 years after that giant lemon of a meeting, Joseph Smith took matters into his own hands. He declared himself mayor of Nauvoo, taking over for his good buddy, Mr. John C. Bennett. This was only just the beginning of a pattern that still continues today, where Mormonism began organizing not only a religious kingdom, but a political kingdom as well. The thinking went something like this. If the American leaders were too dumb to see the sheer coolness of Mormonism, they were either wicked or blind, and either way couldn't be trusted. So Mormons, just like with everything else, had to step in and do government the right way.
And as we talked about in the polygamy episodes, same thing with polygamy. There's polygamy the evil way, there's polygamy the God's way, there's God's laws of marriage, and there's man's laws of marriage. So yeah, this attitude still gives in Mormon groups, from LDS anti-taxers and ranchers like the Bundy family to Mormon fundamentalists and 3%er militia groups and a bunch of pricks to kick against. This attitude about just governments versus corrupt ones is so pervasive in Mormonism today. We are largely, like in the American West, libertarian people, and you throw Mormonism into that, one begets the other. Like, it's hard to tell the chicken or the egg on that. But even still, as you go into more global Mormonism, there's this idea that, you know, God has laws that are different than man's laws or better. And that's still very pervasive, largely in part to how Mormons began structuring their religious organization in the first place. They deliberately blurred political lines with spiritual ones in setting up their own government. In the October 1840 General Conference Sunday morning session, Smith announced his plans for a new way of doing things. Smith appointed his newly found friend John C. Bennett and Robert B. Thompson to help form a new municipal government with judicial power and function. And this is important because especially as we get into the frontier period, we're going to see a lot of the government in the territory be so enmeshed with Mormonism, you just can't separate the two. And some would argue in Utah it's still, you know, very largely that way, although it is changing. But anyway, you know, adding John C. Bennett and Robert B. Thompson in this municipal government really was meant to protect the interests of Mormons and help the Mormon cause.
Right, because if you're going to form a rogue government, you might as well start with the assumption that you are God's chosen people, and thus, laws and organizations should be formed around that. So Smith's BFF, Bennett, works on a city charter for Nauvoo, which was put up for vote by Mormon leaders. At this time, Bennett is the quartermaster general in Illinois, and he uses that position in the legislature to help the Mormons. And though the charter often gets attributed to Bennett, Joseph Smith saw it as his baby. Later on, this statement was attributed to him, quote, "The city charter of Nauvoo is of my own plan and device. I concocted it for the salvation of the church, and on principles so broad that every honest man might dwell secure under its protective influence." This statement was created after John C. Bennett gets booted out of town, so we're not going to want to give Bennett much credit. When the Illinois State Legislature approved the charter in December 1840, it was probably because Bennett, a prominent physician and was somewhat well-known, leveraged his power and persuasive lobbying skills to get it passed. Even a young Abraham Lincoln would apparently be impressed with Bennett's ability to help a minority religious group.
Bennett's lobbying would pay off both in heaven and on earth. Not only did it get Joseph Smith to trust Bennett, becoming a counselor in the First Presidency and the mayor of Nauvoo, the general of the Nauvoo Legion, and the chancellor of Nauvoo University. And like, you gotta understand, when we talk about all of this is in like, well, what, Brian, 2 year period? Basically, this guy moves fast and he sort of turns the dial Mormonism up to like 1500. Plus, the charter was impressive. The Times and Seasons church-owned newspaper bragged that it was, quote, "the most liberal provisions ever granted by a legislative assembly." Like, they really thought highly of themselves. It established a municipal government where the city council was led by a mayor and made up of 9 councilors and 4 aldermen. The judicial branch was a municipal court that consisted of the mayor and the 4 aldermen. And like, in case you don't know what those are, the alderman was like, so Bennett had this position where he was designated as a representative for like the military in his area. And so this is kind of like how they set it up too. They were really kind of recreating American government, but just in a religious setting, and then blurring the lines as we said earlier. So the city council could pass whatever laws that they wanted, so long as they were, quote, "not repugnant to the Constitution of the United States or the state of Illinois." That leaves a lot of wiggle room, that language. The judicial tribunal was especially important because it could grant writs of habeas corpus, which allowed Joseph Smith the get-out-of-jail-free card when his enemies would try to repeatedly get him into prison. And another important feature of this charter is that it allowed the city council to organize a militia, and this they did. They called it the Nauvoo Legion.
Not to do too many spoilers here, but this charter will be such a point of contention later, because when the rest of Illinois is mad that the Mormons are doing all these things they don't like, the Mormons say, hey, it was in the charter. You guys got to vote on it. And I have to think that at that point, Illinois is thinking, well, it was like the user agreement for when you install software. Nobody actually reads that thing. So for all these people, they're already scared of Mormons or at least suspicious of their growing power. The charter definitely did not help matters. Historian Arnold Garr wrote a fascinating article in Mormon Historical Studies about Joseph Smith as mayor, which was really helpful as we put this episode together. In the article, he explains, quote, speaking of the charter, John C. Bennett reported, every power we asked has been granted, every request gratified, every desire fulfilled. One historian claimed, the saints relied on their charter to be an unbreachable wall defending the rights of Zion. Unfortunately, as time passed, many of their non-Mormon neighbors came to view it as an offensive barrier. Missouri had taught them a lesson. The government's not going to take care of you. You got to make your own government, make it so powerful that the rest, you know, the rest of the state can do nothing.
And that offensive barrier would turn into full-blown paranoia. In February of 1841, Nauvoo experienced its first municipal election. And first off, John C. Bennett is voted into office as the first mayor of Nauvoo. Just like right out the gate, we're putting this guy into power. And what's absolutely wild about this is he was a very recent convert. He'd only joined the church a few months earlier. And now all of a sudden he finds his way, like he's super in, thick as thieves with these guys, that Joseph Smith is giving him this kind of power. Historian Arnold Garr continues, quote, a list of the other elected officials reads like a who's who in Latter-day Saint history. The four aldermen were William Marks, Samuel H. Smith, Daniel H. Wells, and Newell K. Whitney. The nine counselors were Joseph Smith, Hiram Smith, Sidney Rigdon, Charles C. Rich, John T. Barrett, Wilson Law, Don Carlos Smith, John P. Green, and Vincent Knight. These names, where have I seen them before? Where do they come up when they're getting special favors? Back to Garr. Some important church leaders missing from this list were members of the Quorum of the Twelve Apostles. This is because most of them were on missions in the British Isles at the time. Joseph Smith served almost 15 months on the city council before becoming mayor. During this time, he was clearly the most energetic member of the body. For example, the council passed 11 ordinances during its first five meetings, and the prophet introduced every one of them. At the first meeting of the city council held on Wednesday, February 3rd, 1841, Joseph Smith gave the opening prayer and the new officers were sworn in. After Mayor Bennett gave his lengthy inaugural address, the prophet introduced bills to organize the Nauvoo Legion and the University of the City of Nauvoo. Both ordinances passed unanimously. The council appointed John C. Bennett as chancellor of the university and William Law as registrar. Joseph Smith, Sidney Rigdon, Hiram Smith, and 20 others were named regents. And the prophet then presented a resolution which formally thanked the governor and legislature for granting the Nauvoo Charter and the citizens of Quincy for the kindness they showed the saints during the Missouri persecutions. The city council also appointed Joseph Smith to serve as a chairman of several committees, including on the canal for vacating the town of Commerce, vending spiritual liquor, Code of City Ordinances, and Board of Health, end quote.
Pop quiz here. What was the mascot of the University of the City of Nauvoo?
Don't look at me like I know that.
The Flaming Angels? I don't know. They didn't have mascots.
Oh, I was like, no, really?
That would be pretty awesome.
What are the odds?
If we can go back in time, we're changing that to their mascot. So who are all these hoity-toity leaders there in Nauvoo? Let's dig into some of them. Actually, let's just do one. We'll save the others for another episode. When you hear about John C. Bennett, he seems to be the kind of guy that makes everything about him. And this episode is no exception. He's probably one of the most notorious saints and scoundrels ever taken into the inner circles of Mormon power. And while his tenure with Joseph Smith would be incredibly short-lived, it would also be incredibly impactful. The Joseph Smith papers in their biography of him has him listed as physician, minister, poultry breeder. But that is not all, not even close. Listen to some more of these items from his biography. It's a mouthful. He joined the Pickaway Masonic Lodge about 1827 in Circleville, Ohio. He was later charged with lying and other misconduct by the lodge. Big surprise. He was a Methodist. He later affiliated with the Christian Disciples, the Campbellite faith. He was commissioned Brigadier General in the 2nd Division in the Illinois Militia in 1839. Then, in 1840, he moves to Nauvoo. He's baptized into the church September 1840 in Nauvoo. He was the Quartermaster General in the Illinois Militia, 1840-42. He was the Major General and Inspector General in the Nauvoo Legion. He was elected to that, February 1841. He served as the Assistant President in the First Presidency, 1841-42. Mayor of Nauvoo, 1841-42, Chancellor of University of Nauvoo, 41-42, Master in Chancery of Hancock County, 1841-42, and the Grand Secretary of the Nauvoo Masonic Lodge, 1841-42. It's quite the resume. I have to feel like his neck got sore from wearing all those hats.
I would just call it religious promiscuity, you know? He just really church-hopped, if you will.
Down to the river of Jordan, oh yes, I'm going down to the river of Jordan.
Bennett is definitely just a controversial character, twirling his mustache, as we've talked about. He's become a sort of cartoon villain for Joseph Smith. He's sort of the bad guy, the shadow in every dark tale of Mormonism. And as we've talked about earlier, and as I've discussed exhaustively elsewhere, Bennett is probably best known for his practice of spiritual wifery, which is basically the idea of attaching yourself romantically or pragmatically through spiritual means to another person, usually a woman who is not your wife. And in Bennett's case, he was known to attach himself to many women and possibly a few men who believed they could be part of a big spiritual commune of love. I mean, it really seems like that. And even Joseph Smith is accused, I think it's by Bennett even, right? That Joseph Smith was into dudes too. So if you're thinking to yourself, now, wait a minute, wasn't he just doing what Joseph Smith was doing? Wasn't he just, you know, experimenting with his practices? He's in the, you know, presidency and whatever, finding himself attached and attracted to other women and building a religious theology around it, right? He's just doing the same thing. Well, yes, it was the same, except Joseph Smith believed his practice, plural marriage, to be kind of a classier deal, one that was sanctioned by God. Bennett, he and others have argued, were doing it out of selfish lust. And it's the same thing we talked about with man's laws and God's laws, polygamy being one thing and this being something else. Joseph Smith was like, yuck, selfish lust. I don't want to live in polygamy. God and his angel with a flaming sword is making me. I don't want to do this.
Hello again. I'm historian Christopher C. Smith, back to tell you a story about free love in Nauvoo. In May 1842, the Nauvoo High Council put John C. Bennett and several other men on trial for illicit intercourse with women. The men had been part of a sort of Nauvoo sex ring. They cited religious justifications for having sex with a lot of women who were not their wives. Bennett later called this practice spiritual wifery. The practice is most prominently associated with Bennett, but another leading practitioner who was up for excommunication in the May 1842 High Council trial was none other than the prophet's own brother, William Smith. The trial record reveals a lot about what these men were doing. The gist of the testimony was that these men approached women and solicited extramarital sex, which they explained to the women was not a sin under Mormon doctrine. None of their propositions involved marriage proposals. They were purely sexual. The men promised that Bennett was on hand to provide abortions should the women get pregnant. The men doing the soliciting included John C. Bennett, William Smith, Chauncey Higbee, Lyman O. Littlefield, Joel S. Miles, John Darwin Chase, George W. Thatcher, Jacob Bakenstos, and Justice Morse. Although they claimed their actions were morally and religiously justified, at least one of the men involved was not even a baptized Mormon. Jacob Bakenstos was, however, a Freemason, and it's likely that this little sex ring was headquartered at the Nauvoo Masonic Lodge, just like a lot of the other shady stuff that happened at Nauvoo. The women these men solicited included Catherine Fuller, Sarah Miller, Sarah Campbell Brown, Melissa Schindel, Rachel and Ellen Kingsley, and Margaret and Matilda Nyman. Two of these women, Rachel and Ellen Kingsley, were not members of the LDS Church. Their family had come to Nauvoo to join the church, but they had decided not to join in consequence of the conduct and proceedings of some in the church. Several of the women testified at the High Council trial about the solicitations, so we have their firsthand accounts of what the men said to them. Just as an example, let's look at Chauncey Higbee's approach to a widow named Sarah Miller. Chauncey came to Miller's house in the spring of 1842. According to Sarah Miller, he first asked her how long it had been since her husband had died, and he sort of joked about when might she consider marrying again. Then he sat very close to her, and he began seducing insinuations by saying it was no harm to have sexual intercourse with women if they would keep it to themselves. He urged me vehemently, she says, to yield to his desires. And he said that there is no harm in it, and Joseph Smith says so. Sarah expressed skepticism about that, for she had heard Joseph Smith teach against adultery from the pulpit. But Chauncey said that didn't mean single women, but married women. Eventually, Sarah yielded to his temptations, having received the strongest assurance from him that Joseph approved it and would uphold me in it. When they finished having sex, Sarah expressed worry that she had done wrong. However, Chauncey assured her that it was right, and he promised to bring a witness to confirm what he had taught. When he came again, the prophet's brother, William Smith, came with him. And Sarah says, William told me that the doctrine which Chauncey Higbee had taught me was true, and that Joseph believed the doctrine. William said that he would take all the sin to himself, for there was no sin in it. Before leaving Sarah's house on this occasion, Chauncey promised that no one would ever know about their liaison. Sarah replied that it might be told in bringing forth pregnancy. Chauncey said that there is no danger, and that Dr. Bennett understood it all and would come and take it away if there was anything. Other women who testified at the trial had similar experiences to Sarah. The men sought consent from them for sexual intercourse, but they, quote, urged hard, and they insisted on what they called their rights and their privileges. So this was fairly coercive propositioning. The women generally said that they, quote, yielded to the men's desires. Keep in mind that this was a society in which women had no legal right to refuse sex to their husbands, and they had little legal right to seek divorce. So the women may have submitted to sex just as a sort of matter of course, as a cultural norm. Hey, even today, a lot of people find it hard to say no to high-pressure sales tactics. So if the men were insistent enough, then the women may have felt that they had little choice. The trial testimony also hints at an element of prostitution in some of these relationships. Jacob Bakenstos offered widow Catherine Fuller $2 in exchange for sex, and William Smith and Chauncey Higbee both offered to keep her supplied with food. In an age when women mostly didn't work outside the home, widows like Fuller found it hard to earn a living after their husbands passed away. In fact, 19th century feminists often compared the institution of marriage to prostitution because women married for survival, not for love. It's possible, of course, that there was some genuine romance involved in these transactions as well. The women say they were seduced, and a witness described John C. Bennett and Sarah Campbell Brown sitting close together like lovers. Nor should we discount the women's own libidos as motivations for agreeing to have sex, because, contrary to popular belief, women generally like sex too. The Kingsley girls were rumored to have had a bad reputation in the various places they lived, Missouri and Pennsylvania, which I take to mean they probably knew how to have a good time. The trial record also offers insight into the religious rationalizations that the men offered the women for why extramarital sex was okay. There are two main points. First, the biblical prohibition against adultery only applies to married women, according to these men. So it's perfectly okay for single women to have sex with whoever they want. In fact, when widow Catherine Fuller got remarried, William Smith approached her on her wedding day and, quote, insisted very much that I should not marry, unquote. Because if she married again, then William would no longer be able to have sex with her, or it would be adultery. Now, William Smith was himself married, so apparently this prohibition against extramarital sex for a married person only applied to women, not for men. It was adultery for a married woman to have sex with another man, but it was not adultery for a married man to have sex with a woman besides his wife. John C. Bennett apparently didn't observe even this limited prescription because one of his sexual partners, Sarah Campbell Brown, was a married woman. She was married to a man named Albert Brown. The second religious rationalization that these men cited was Joseph Smith's teaching that there was no sin where there was no accuser. Now, we know for a fact that Joseph Smith taught this, because we have a record of him teaching it in a public sermon on October 7th, 1841, the previous year. In that sermon, he said, "If we did not accuse one another, God would not accuse us. And if we had no accuser, we should enter heaven. If we would not accuse him," meaning Joseph, "he would not accuse us. And if we would throw a cloak of charity over his sins, he would over ours. For charity covered a multitude of sins, and what many people called sin was not sin." Privately, Joseph seems to have taught his inner circle that this doctrine that there's no sin where there's no accuser means extramarital sex isn't wrong as long as you don't get caught. As Chauncey Higbee explained it to Matilda Nyman, he had been, quote, instructed by Joseph Smith that there could be no wrong in having sexual intercourse with any female that would keep the same to herself. Likewise, William Smith assured Sarah Miller that, quote, "he would take all the sin to himself, for there was no sin in it." And John C. Bennett and Lyman O. Littlefield both told Catherine Fuller that, quote, "there should be no sin come upon her. If there was any sin, they would take it upon themselves." The principle that it's not wrong if you don't get caught means, of course, that it becomes really imperative not to get caught. And we see that the men really made a lot of effort not to get caught. All of the men urged secrecy upon the women they propositioned. That was a condition of the transaction, that the women would keep it quiet. When neighbors caught Catherine Fuller in flagrante, Higbee and Littlefield went to a lawyer named Gustavus Hills and got a 3-month restraining order to keep the neighbor women quiet. And as I already mentioned, John C. Bennett provided abortions as a means of keeping the secret. Catherine Fuller says that when Bennett sexually propositioned her, he said, quote, "if I should become pregnant, he would attend to that. I understood that he would give medicine to prevent it." Despite these precautions, the men did get caught eventually. In all, 3 of the women testified at the excommunication trial that 4 of the men, including the prophet's brother William, had directly attributed this free love doctrine to Joseph Smith. But when the story broke, and rumors started flying in Nauvoo, Joseph publicly disavowed the doctrine and the offenders. Lyman O. Littlefield, one of the excommunicated men, ultimately concluded, he told his sister-in-law, that Smith had practiced a sort of spiritual entrapment. A week before the trial, Littlefield told his sister-in-law, Rachel Kingsley, quote, that Joseph tried to persuade men to act wickedly and then exposed them, unquote, and that he now believed Joseph disapprobated extramarital sex. William Smith and Chauncey Higbee gave a different explanation for why Joseph seemed to be saying different things publicly and privately about this issue. William told Catherine Fuller, quote, that Joseph was obliged to teach the contrary on the stand to keep down prejudice and keep peace at home, unquote. And Chauncey Higbee told Sarah Miller, quote, that Joseph now taught as he did through necessity on account of the prejudices of the people and his own family particularly, as they had not become full believers in the doctrine. So in other words, the church did not accept the idea of extramarital sex, and especially Joseph Smith's own family did not accept the idea of extramarital sex, and therefore Joseph Smith had to publicly disavow it. This is quite plausible because, of course, we know that Emma was a strong opponent of polygamy and of Joseph Smith's various liaisons with other women. It's worth noting that although several of these men got excommunicated, the prophet's brother William faced no consequences. According to the diary of Abraham H. Cannon, quote, the prophet Joseph instructed President of the Quorum of the Twelve Apostles, Brigham Young, to bring a charge against William for adultery. Before the time set for the trial, however, Emma Smith talked to Joseph and said the charge preferred against William was with view to injuring the Smith family. After the trial had begun, Joseph entered the room and was given a seat. The testimony of witnesses concerning the culprit's sins was then continued. After a short time, Joseph arose filled with wrath and said, Brother Brigham, I will not listen to this abuse of my family a minute longer. I will wade in blood up to my knees before I will do it. This was a supreme moment, Abraham H. Cannon says. A rupture between the two greatest men on earth seemed imminent, but Brigham Young was equal to the danger, and he instantly said, Brother Joseph, I withdraw the charge. Thus the angry passions were instantly stilled. In fact, we can see in the handwritten trial documents where William's name has been scratched out of the record of the witness's testimony. With his behavior unchecked, William went on to start another sex ring in the city of Boston just 2 years later while serving a mission there in 1844. He taught the free love doctrine to George J. Adams, Samuel Brannan, and Joseph Ball Jr., and these four men began seducing women in the Boston ward. When this came out, Brigham Young initially chose to cover up William's sins with the cloak of charity, just as Joseph Smith had done in 1842. Only 7 months later, when William challenged Young for leadership of the church, Young's charity ran out, and William was finally excommunicated for apostasy. I had a vision plain and true. Saw something that few people do. Lord God, I think I've seen enough. I had a vision true and plain. That crack, broken, rusty ghost train. That once you're on, you can't get off. I saw their eyes, I saw their eyes, I saw their eyes. I saw their eyes, I saw their eyes, I saw their eyes.
Now, it is true that Bennett really was a shady character. When he gets to Nauvoo, he presents himself as a bachelor, but then the Mormons get suspicious, they send some guys back to Ohio, they dig around in his dirty laundry, and discovered he was actually married, and according to the Times and Seasons, quote, his poor but confiding wife followed him from place to place with no suspicion of his unfaithfulness to her. At length, however, he became so bold in his departures that it was evident all around that he was a sore offender, and his wife left him under satisfactory evidence of his adulterous connections. Who doesn't want to hear from Mrs. Bennett? I think she would be fascinating to listen to. Here's the rub, though. There is still debate to this day whether or not Bennett was just following the example of Joseph Smith or doing his own thing. In a letter to the Iowa Hawkeye, published in December of 1843, Bennett, for his part, would maintain that the idea of eternal marriage was an entirely new doctrine to him. The crux of the confusion for historians like his biographer, Andrew Smith, or historian Brian Hills, is that though Bennett may have known about Joseph Smith's affiliation with other women, he hadn't really been taught the concept of eternal marriage, going beyond the bonds of the grave, whether that was monogamous or polygamous.
Yeah, Bennett really wasn't one for formalities, unless it's all the titles you want to carry in Nauvoo. I mean, he did establish the charter, but as we can see, the idea that some government actions were corrupt while the Lord's government was righteous might have helped Bennett work out the fact that he believed that anybody, man or woman, could have sexual relations without a marriage ceremony. Again, we talked about this earlier, but these are not unique to human cultures. All of these human cultures are trying to figure out how to build, you know, culture and society around human behavior. And John C. Bennett acted like other men that you might know. And Joseph Smith probably did too. Check out what Catherine Fulmer had to say when she testified before the Nauvoo High Council in May of 1842. She said, quote, nearly a year ago, I became acquainted with John C. Bennett after visiting twice, and on the third time, he proposed unlawful intercourse, being about 1 week after first acquaintance. He said he wished his desires granted. I told him it was contrary to my feelings. He assured me that there was others in higher standing than I who would conduct in that way, and there was no harm in it. He said there should be no sin upon me. If there was any sin, it should come upon himself. John C. Bennett was the first man that seduced me. No man ever made the attempt before him, end quote. I just want to say something else about this, because I talk about this as being human behavior, and I want to be clear. It's very clear from her account. This is problematic. It was coercive. It was abusive. She didn't want it. And so I don't mean to say when I say, you know, I know all these ex-Mormons that are doing it, or, you know, it's part of human behavior. There are people that are consensually living unique relationship styles, but this is not it. Like, this is John C. Bennett, like, shaming and forcing women. And we know this because both he and Joseph Smith, if a woman comes forward and says something, these men destroy their reputations publicly.
And Bennett's theology is pretty easy to boil down. A, he said he wished his desires granted. That's pretty easy. And then how do we do that? There was others in higher standing, so we'll appeal to authority. It's a very simple theology. Quite elegant, I might add. So the thing is, the trouble wasn't just about who was sleeping with who. The trouble was, in part, Bennett just didn't possess the sort of discretion Joseph Smith would have liked. Joseph Smith at least knew about some of what Bennett was doing in real time. Witnesses like Lorenzo Wasson, who was Emma's nephew, claimed to have heard Joseph Smith lecturing Bennett about his naughty behavior. Bennett was loud and out about his big love ideas. This did not help Smith's reputation. In fact, Joseph Smith would find himself in the hot seat more than once because of Bennett. His friend John C. and all his philandering just helped to blow up the rumors that Smith was practicing spiritual wifery himself. But remember, friends, Joseph Smith never practiced spiritual wifery. That was lower law stuff for the riffraff. Smith was more a new and everlasting covenant sort of guy. And you get the difference, right? Much higher and holier. When he married ladies, he did it under the principle of plural marriage. Important distinction.
So if Bennett was such a liability to the church, or even better, a wicked sinner who brought additional persecution on the prophets, why wasn't he ousted earlier? Well, okay, so that question gets sticky, because let's hear what historian Brian Hills has to say. Quote, apparently, Joseph Smith exercised extreme patience with John C. Bennett. Concerning forgiveness, the prophet taught that the Relief Society in May of 1842, quote, they are fellow mortals. We loved them once. Shall we not encourage them to reformation? We have not yet forgiven them 70 times 7, as our Savior directed. Perhaps we have not forgiven them once. There is now a day of salvation to such as repent and reform, and they who repent not should be cast out from this society. Yet we should woo them to return to God, lest they escape not the damnation of hell." End quote. By late spring of 1842, it's obvious that the mayor was not going to change his ways. Like, you can't change a John C. Bennett. When finally confronted, quote, "He said he had seduced 6 or 7 women in the city, and if he was forgiven, he would not be guilty anymore." However, Bennett's improprieties could no longer be ignored. He resigned as mayor on May 17th and was disfellowshipped. This day, he signed a public confession. Quote, "Personally appeared before me Daniel H. Wells, the alderman of City of Nauvoo, John C. Bennett, who being duly sworn according to law, deposeth and saith that he was never taught anything in the least contrary to the strictest principles of the gospel or of virtue or of the laws of God or man under any circumstances or upon any occasion, either directly or indirectly in word or deed, by Joseph Smith, and he never knew the said Smith to countenance any improper conduct whatever, either in public or private, and that he never did teach me in private that an illegal illicit intercourse with females was under any circumstances justifiable, and that I never knew him so to teach others." End quote. Joseph Smith later complained, "The only sin I ever committed was in exercising sympathy and covering up their iniquities," meaning John C. Bennett, "on their solemn promise to reform, and of this I am ashamed and will never do so again." And I just want to say something about that, because that's so interesting to me. You know, for a long time, I think even when I did Year of Polygamy, I believed Joseph at his word. But now, as I've gone sort of the history and we've covered it here, like, there are reasons why Joseph Smith was asking for a lot of forgiveness and a lot of second chances, because Joseph Smith got lots of those all the time. He was always getting into trouble. And when people try to distance Joseph from John C. Bennett, they're like, "Oh, he was just such a good and loving guy. He welcomed everyone in." I don't know. I think those two got along because they were very similar. They liked power, and it was sort of a power struggle, the entire thing, in my view, over authority.
I mean, it really could be that he was just practicing extreme patience, but it seems like a more likely scenario is that Joseph Smith's own hands weren't clean on the matter. When he goes to the Relief Society and says, "We need to throw a cloak of charity over everything," he's talking about himself there as much as he is anyone else. I mean, as you know, by this point, he's married a boatload of women. Not exaggerating. Like, you could actually fill a boat or two or three or four with all the women he's married secretly in Nauvoo. And this made it tricky for him to expose a friend to something he was trying to keep under wraps from his own wife. And whether you follow the line of reasoning that Joseph Smith's polygamy was sanctioned by God and Bennett's wasn't, let's just say the general public had a hard time finding the difference.
When Bennett was ousted, he didn't leave quietly. He was not one to do things on the DL. He liked to go big or go home. Feeling like a scapegoat for a lot of Smith's bad behavior, he just sort of goes on the offensive. He would write an expose and at least 6 letters to the nearby Sangamo Journal, which are a fun read if you're interested, detailing the crimes of Mormons. Later, he would become mostly known as like this big enemy to the church. But one of his most controversial practices that we only have sketchy details about was the idea that he sort of used his position as a doctor and physician to help give women abortions who became pregnant from spiritual wifery or plural marriage or whatever was going on in Nauvoo. While this is likely true because historically abortions have always been around, even when we don't want them to be, we don't have a lot of evidence that he helped plural wives of Joseph Smith get rid of their pregnancies. And I don't know why we would. The practice was so secretive as it is. Can you imagine adding this layer to it? But John C. Bennett seems like the kind of guy that would be down for that. And it's likely that in the last years of Nauvoo, the doctrine didn't demand that sort of sacrifice. One of the later explanations for polygamy was to produce these righteous heirs of the gospel. But it is plausible to believe that in those early days, especially the tumultuous 22 months that Bennett was helping Smith establish a city, that any pregnancies from any shenanigans were best terminated or kept secret for the safety and reputations of everybody involved. I mean, it would have destroyed women's entire lives to be found, pregnant from someone outside of their marriage. But since the abortion stuff always comes up, and I'm not kidding, I get this question probably from more people than any other questions regarding the history. Let's just dig into it a bit, because I think, you know, people are interested in this for a reason. It's something interesting to explore.
Give me that old-fashioned morphine. Give me that old-fashioned morphine. Give me that old-fashioned morphine. That's good enough for me.
So I'm going to refer you back to Brian Hales, and I know a lot of you think he's an apologist about this, and maybe he is, but I think he lists some of the best documentation for the Bennett abortions on his site. Although a well-documented philanderer, John C. Bennett did not leave behind a trail of pregnancies and illegitimate children. He was a trained obstetrician and presumably would have had the knowledge of how to abort a pregnancy. There are, in fact, three historical documents that associate Bennett with abortion. Hiram Smith testified in 1842 that Bennett assuaged the fears of the women he seduced by promising he would give them medicine to produce abortions, providing they should become pregnant. Also, Mrs. Zeruiah Goddard affirmed on August 28, 1842, Mrs. Pratt stated to me that Dr. Bennett told her that he could cause abortion with perfect safety to the mother at any stage of pregnancy, and that he had frequently destroyed and removed infants before their time to prevent exposure of the parties, and that he had instruments for that purpose. And Sarah Pratt described the instrument Bennett may have used, quote, a pretty long instrument of a kind I've never seen before. It seemed to be a steel and was crooked at one end, end quote. These statements document that Bennett claimed he was capable of inducing via medications or performing with surgical instrumentation an abortion. As a licensed physician and experienced obstetrician, he may have done so in Nauvoo. In 1825, John C. Bennett passed the exam then required to practice medicine. In 1837, he published the Accoucheur's Vade Mecum, an account of his obstetrical experiences. Sarah Pratt also claimed in the late 1880s that Bennett not only performed abortions in Nauvoo, but some of them were on Joseph Smith's plural wives. Anti-Mormon writer Wilhelm Weil quoted Sarah, quote, you hear often that Joseph had no polygamous offspring. The reason of this is very simple. Abortion was practiced on a large scale in Nauvoo. Dr. John C. Bennett, the evil genius of Joseph, brought this abomination into a scientific system. He showed to my husband and me the instruments which he may have used to operate for Joseph. There was a house in Nauvoo right across the flat, about a mile and a half from town, a kind of hospital. They sent the women there when they showed signs of celestial consequences. Abortion was practiced regularly in this house. Sarah claimed many things about Joseph Smith throughout her lifetime, but this is probably one of her most over-the-top statements. She made other allegations that contradict more reliable historical data. For example, when asked about the statement, Joseph had 80 wives at the time of his death, Sarah Pratt replied, he had many more, my dear. At least he had seduced many more. And those with whom he had lived without their being sealed to him were sealed to him after his death. Currently, there is no evidence for 80 wives or many more than 8, as Pratt alleged. So all of that was really from Brian Hales' site on abortion, and I would recommend going and looking at it because it really has all of these sources right there for you, and you can see and you can look at them yourselves. And so we have Brian Hales to thank for that.
And to Brian's credit, he says this all the time. He says, start with the sources, be familiar with those, read through those, and then we can talk. And that really, that's very credible. I mean, that's start with the sources, then go from there. And it's really interesting. One thing, actually, my mom and I were talking about this today, the idea of Bennett as doctor. And it's interesting in there, you know, the fact that he's a licensed physician. Come on now.
I mean, he held titles to everything. He was a man who knew how to get titles.
He did diploma mill colleges. But the idea of a licensed physician in 1840 means practically nothing. It means like you know how to use leeches. The medical knowledge at the time was not great. Now, the fact that he has an instrument, that's, to me, that's a little more damning, because if he's got an instrument, he probably knows how to use it. So
he was an obstetrician, right? Like, here's a man that we're going to put in charge of women's health. With his reputation, I can see, I'm not saying John C. Bennett is a good character and he's being framed at all in Mormonism, but it does bother me when people are like, Joseph Smith had no idea. I mean, he did though. He did. At least some of it.
Yeah, he knew about some of it. That's pretty, you can't argue that. So Bennett gives Mormonism the good old college try and is subsequently given the boot. But extricating him from all of his positions was a very complicated process. As Lindsay mentioned earlier, he resigns as mayor in 1842 and then is disfellowshipped. He's also cashiered from the Nauvoo Legion. I mean, who doesn't want to get cashiered? I don't even know.
What does that even mean?
It's basically just they kick him out, but for some reason they have this awesome turn.
It sounds fancier. Very John C. Bennett of them.
There you go. He's expelled from the Masonic Lodge, and also his divorce from long-suffering Mrs. Bennett is finalized at this time.
I can only think of Jane Austen. Mrs. Bennett.
Did she also have a mustache she twirled?
Maybe it was different then.
But the question of his church membership is the most complicated one. There was a notice published in the Times and Seasons that was dated May 11th, it's published later, but it indicated that the First Presidency and Apostles, quote, withdrew the hand of fellowship. Then, May 17th, he's apparently allowed to withdraw his membership. It's really interesting, when he publishes his letters in the Sangamo Journal, he includes, we assume, legitimate correspondence from Joseph Smith to his clerk, James Sloan, saying, let this guy withdraw. And then James Sloan writes back saying, okay, he withdrew. Then, apparently, the next month in June, he was completely excommunicated once and for all. It's very interesting. Like, if you look, you'll see he was disfellowshipped, or others will say he was excommunicated. It seems like it was both at different times, but there's very little record of it, which, for Bennett, I think is odd. Who knows? Big surprise. There's mystery in his story. So then for a few years, he just kind of rages on Mormonism and then gives it up. But he took one more attempt at conversion, maybe just to make sure he wasn't, you know, maybe he still wants to be a Mormon. So when Joseph Smith is murdered, Bennett finds himself yearning for Zion. He doesn't go to a ranch. He instead joins up with Sidney Rigdon in his movement, and then later with James Strang, the very fascinating guy who most patterned his bid for succession on being Joseph Smith 2.0. And so the Strangites move to Beaver Island in Michigan, a place that I would very much like to go visit, and they start their own little attempt of Smith and Rigdon's obsession for a communal order. So they create this communal order called the Halcyon Order of the Illuminati. See, the Illuminati are real. James Strang was in on it.
FLDS knew this all along.
One of the key features of Strang's group that Bennett was most excited about? You guessed it, spiritual wifery. But, like free love tends to be, it wasn't free. And Bennett also gets excommunicated from these guys in 1847 amidst allegations of sexual misconduct. Did not see that coming.
Bennett's biographer, Andrew Smith, notes that it wasn't all hookers and blow for John C. Bennett. As a poultry breeder, which John C. Bennett was, among of his many, many, many talents, he was a Renaissance man of sorts. He invented a new kind of chicken called the rock fowl, raised both for its meat and for its brown eggs. It's a chicken that's resistant to cold, easy to manage, and a good sitter. So that's cool, I guess, except for I went and tried to verify this, and Wikipedia doesn't back this up. They don't say who, like, invented it, but it wasn't John C. Bennett. So either John C. Bennett's a liar, or someone needs to update Wikipedia. It might be that John C. Bennett's a liar. Anyway, he was also a big proponent of the tomato, which many 19th century idiots were skeptical of. God bless the tomato. I'm so glad he is an activist for it. I love tomatoes. I love canning tomatoes. And he was said to be a pioneer in the use of chloroform as an anesthetic. This one bummed me out. Like, it bummed me out that this was the thing he knew really well. He even published in his findings in 1848 about, although knowing a little about his sexual history and his course of practices, I'm not going to chalk this one up in the great achievement category. It really kind of skews me out. Though there were rumors about Bennett that still persist today, like him helping orchestrate the murder of Smith, there's little evidence to back it up. Bennett fired off similar rumors saying that the Mormon Danites, dressed in drag, made an attempt on his life in May of 1842. I don't know. Checks out. Feels like it checks out.
That's when you want to be true.
King, like Porter Rockwell in a dress. Yeah, it happened. Probably more than once. So to us, he's just evidence of the kind of men swimming around the frontier of the time, building community. Like Smith, he had sometimes parallel visions for things, but unlike Smith, he wasn't called and sanctioned by God. Bad luck, better luck next time. No matter how hard he tried, God just didn't sanction his stuff like he did Joseph Smith's. He would drop off the historical record, largely unknown except for his connections to Mormonism. He would die with his poultry books and bitterness for Mormonism at the age of 63 in Polk City, Iowa.
Tell that devil to take you back, take you back, take you back. My wind for red to black.
Say, what now? It must be time for the Books of Mormon report. I think you'll agree with me that tonight's book wins the award for Weirdest Path to Mormon Studies. Andrew Smith, who's just store brand Smith, no connection to, you know, the Smiths. He's a food history guy. And I kid you not, he wrote a book about ketchup. We assume that after his inevitable conversion, he'll write the sequel on fry sauce. But so he's reading this book that mentions a Dr. Bennett who was promoting tomatoes in the mid-19th century. And like Lindsay mentioned, he's like, wait a minute, I thought everyone knew that tomatoes were deadly poison. He eventually figures out it's our guy John C. Bennett, and off he goes down the biography trail. And poor Andrew, I feel sorry for these dudes like him and John Turner, total outsiders, who just have to jump in and figure out all this crazy-ass Mormon craziness. Well, he figured it out, and he gave us a fine book on this very fascinating saintly scoundrel.
Blood, oh brother young, and let his smoke ascend to heaven, brother Brigham, brother young, and let my breast be cut asunder, brother young, as an offering for my sins, a smoking incense, brother young, a blood atoning for my sinning, brother young, cause I sinned so gravely, brother Brigham, brother young.
The song you heard today is called Brother Brigham, Brother Young by an artist, Corb Lund. Check out his music at corblund.com and consider giving a donation to sunstone.org to support this podcast.